This is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, April 2nd, 2021. Producing from his home studio in the foothills of Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my hotel room in Washington before I head out to L.A. for the White Sox and Angels game on Sunday night. Taylor, opening day is in the book. What a fun day. What a rotten day.
I know, right? You got the short end of the stick there, being in D.C., the game being canceled. I'm getting texts from friends being like, does Buster have any scoop on if they're canceling the series? And then we just had a ton of great baseball, so it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I was really looking forward to that game. DeGrom and Max Scherzer and Francisco Lindor's first plate appearance for the Mets. It was going to be so much fun, so that was a bummer. But I got to tell you, you know, the rest of the day, sitting back and you know, watching the other broadcasts, I get to watch the Blue Jays and the Yankees and the Rockies and the Dodgers and the Astros and the Athletics last night. It was in the end, it was opening day and they'll get through this. So the news broke yesterday that the Washington Nationals had more positive tests for COVID-19 after that one that they learned about on Wednesday. So according to Major League Baseball, out of an abundance of caution, they postponed Thursday's game. They will not play today. They're hoping to play as soon as Saturday, but it's obviously a fluid situation. Houston Astros shortstop Carlos Correa talked to reporters and said he's planning for free agency and he seeks a big, long contract. He told reporters that the Astros and he weren't even close on a deal, which we talked about, $120 million offer in light of some of the other deals that have gone out there. Not even close. The Angels and infielder David Fletcher did agree to a five-year, $26 million extension. It also includes two options, giving the Angels an opportunity to buy out as many as three free agent years. As I say, baseball played yesterday, and a crazy situation happened in the Dodgers and Rockies game. Here's Dave Fleming on ESPN.
Cody Bellinger hit a ball. Raimel Tapia, the left fielder for the Rockies, jumped up to try to catch it. It was in his glove. He hit the wall. It popped out of his glove, went over the wall. Justin Turner, who was on the bases for the Dodgers, didn't know where the ball was. He thought it was caught. He started sprinting back to first. Cody Bellinger passed him. So his home run gets wiped off because Bellinger passed the runner. He's out. And the Dodgers only got one run on what appeared to be a two-run homer.
Yeah, at the end of the year, if Cody Bellinger falls one home run shy of leading the league, he might have something to say to Justin Turner. I'm kidding. I'm sure that they had or will be able to have a laugh about that situation as they move forward. Dave Roberts, the Dodgers manager, talked about the umpire. Maybe should he have been more aggressive on his call?
I don't think that, you know, from what I understand, he didn't give the out call. So I don't think that he was still trying to see it. And once he did see the ball go over, he gave the home run call. So I think at that point in time, though, Justin had already retreated. So, it's just one of those funky plays that I don't think it's going to happen again this year.
I would agree with that. He also talked about more about the Bellinger play.
I don't think there was a blame to be placed, Bill. I think that Cody was coming out of the box hard, which he should have. And he's kind of looking at where the ball's at, going hard. Justin was just past second base, I think. And then when he saw the ball in Tapia's glove, he retreated and, you know, put his head down to try to get back to potentially be doubled up. And then at that point in time, they just kind of got crossed right there between first and second.
We talked all spring about how it's going to be a big year for Gary Sanchez, the Yankees catcher. He came up for his first plate appearance. And guess what?
Did he get that one? Gary Sanchez. El Kraken to start on opening day, and a home run for Sanchez puts the Yankees on top.
Carl Ravitch with that call, and we're going to be talking with Carl in a few minutes, and I'll ask him about Gary Sanchez's first day on the ball field. Now, it was 2-2, top of the 10th inning. They went to the extra inning rules, put a runner at second base, and this is what happened for the Blue Jays.
As Grichuk slashes the ball to right field, Judge back, and it's over his head. And now it bounces back by him towards the infield. Davis is in to score. Grichuk is at second with an RBI double, and the Blue Jays have taken the lead.
That was our friend Dan Shulman on 590, the Fan. Blue Jays win 3-2. Aaron Boone, the Yankees manager, talked about fans being in the ballpark.
They didn't end the way you want to, where you're shaking hands. But it was definitely special having a crowd back in there. And you know, even though we're 20% capacity, you could feel their energy and feel them waiting to erupt. You know, obviously we had some chances to take that and just couldn't break through there. But it was definitely something that we don't take for granted, being able to have people back in the building, and hopefully we can continue to build on that.
Tigers and the Indians. Miguel Cabrera this year could pass 500 homers and 3,000 hits, and he got off to a good start in his first plate appearance.
Waiting on a 1-1 in a scoreless game. First inning, swinging a high fly ball to the snowflakes and right. Deep. Naylor back to the wall, looking up, and it's gone! A home run! About it. Miguel Cabrera slides into second because he thought it was a double.
Dan Dickerson with that call, 97.1. The ticket, the Tigers are going to win this game 3-2. Now, before we get to Carl Ravitch and to Todd Radom with our weekly quiz, Rock Kubacko will help us wrap up our team previews talking about the Baltimore Orioles. And we're going to hear from Francisco Lindor. Fight fans, if you want the best UFC experience, you need ESPN Plus. With ESPN Plus, you get pay-per-view events, live fight nights, exclusive originals, and an extensive archive. Sign up now at ESPNplus.com.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
All aboard. It's the Rabby Train with Carl Ravitch.
Carl Ravitch, of course, play-by-play man for ESPN, the host of Baseball Tonight. I don't think the Rabby Train has actually pulled into a station in about 2 days, Rabby. You're doing about every game that I see on television.
Well, the Rabby Train has been idling, stationary, but it's been so great. But yesterday was a great day. The MLB Top 100 a couple days before was great. If for no other reason, you got to see people in the seats. You felt like it was baseball. There was a little sense of what we're all used to. And being with Tim and Eddie in the studio at the same time was wonderful. I mean, it really was. It was like a bit of a homecoming and a reunion, and it felt great.
Boy, and you mentioned, I mean, the highlight of the day, without a doubt, the fans back in the ballpark and how different it felt. You know, that first game that you did, the Blue Jays and Yankees game, it just was like like an exhale, like, whew, thank goodness we're back to this.
That's what it felt like. I mean, you could just kind of breathe, you know, you could breathe again. And a lot of folks were breathing, and a lot of folks by about the sixth inning seemed to say, you know what, we're outside, it's baseball, I'm going to leave the mask around my neck, I'm going to occasionally take a bite or a drink, and I'm good. More important, they were screaming, yelling, booing. They were doing things that fans do literally like we were in a time warp. And we were, you know, back pre-pandemic, and they were upset with strikeouts, and they were happy when Cole struck somebody out. And they weren't too pleased with the way that, you know, Vlad Guerrero or Teoscar Hernandez were hitting the baseball. So, yeah, it felt very, very much like pre-pandemic with regards to baseball. And it was, look, all the emotions that go in with it, you know, it's one of those things where you're like, God, I realize now what we've been missing and how important you know, baseball or whatever event that you've been missing that you can now participate in again. It, you know, in a lot of ways, it's just, it, it's really sad and it's really, really great that we're able to do these things again and how much you really take them for granted. You miss the hell out of them when they're not there. And we missed them for a long, long time.
Yeah, Giancarlo Stanton got the full New York experience. On one hand, you get fans back in the stands. You get the adrenaline, the excitement of fans in Yankee Stadium. And on the other hand, when he struck out late in the game, he got booed, which wasn't going to happen last year with the sound. Give me a couple moments. And, of course, you know, yesterday there was a damper put on some of it because of what happened with the Nationals and the Mets. But before we get to all that, give me a couple of moments that were really fun that stood out to you during the day.
Yeah, so, you know, if you were to just kind of list them, the fans would be number one. I just thought that the – and I think that the players were reflective of the fans. The emotions that we saw when the Phillies wanted a walk-off and Didi Gregorius tackled the baseball to make sure there's no way this ball hits the ground. And Gene Segura, you know, does a Brett Phillips quasi-dance as they won a game. And it felt like they had clinched a wild card spot or clinched a league championship when it was, if, you know, think about it in context. It was game one of 162, and they are celebrating like children. The Brewers did the same thing when they won. And seeing Lorenzo Cain, who opted out last year, get a secondary lead like Mookie Betts last year in the World Series, slide across home plate on a really well-played ball at second base to win for the Brewers. And that massive celebration, that was the exhale. That was the relief. That was the exaltation. That was the, I'm climbing the mountain and I'm screaming because I'm doing what I want and I'm doing what I love and I'm doing it with my guys and I'm doing it in front of people. Those two things through the course of the day, and we were there the whole day and watched all the games. I was just, you know, so, I guess, pumped to see the reaction like that. Sort of, again, for everyone else, you know, like a big fist pump, like, yeah, we are back and we are going to celebrate and we're going to, you know, we're going to play with joy. And I love the celebrations of one game and winning on a walk-off and the celebrations just on the first day. I thought that was really, really, really reaffirming.
This was neat for me. I mean, besides Miguel Cabrera hitting that home run, his first plate appearance into the snow and sliding into second base because he didn't know where the ball was.
Where it was.
Brian Hayes, who is, of course, one of baseball's rising superstars in his first plate appearance of the year.
The Pirates have a man on, and Key Brian Hayes drives one to deep left field, and Key Brian Hayes on opening day hits a two-run homer. How do you like this kid?
That from the Pirates television network. Yeah. How do you like this kid? What a star it looks like we're having. And that was a bomb. And the other thing I was going to mention from yesterday, Carl, we talked so much in spring training about Gary Sanchez and, you know, how this is kind of a crossroad year in his career. The Yankees are going to have to make a decision very soon about whether or not to invest in him long term. And boy, he had a nice first day, as you know, because you did that game.
Yeah, he had an all-around good first day, like really good. Because you start out, and he's in the lineup, and Cole pitched. So right away, that's sort of test number one, because Higashioka wasn't behind the plate. It was Gary, and he was really good. You know, there was not a lot of shakeoffs. I spoke with Buck Showalter a couple of days ago, and, you know, one of the things he said about catchers or personal catchers, and it wasn't just about Sanchez, it was the concept of personal catchers, is when that guy isn't behind the plate, it's not necessarily a question of his, you know, not being on the same page a couple of times. It's the idea that if he puts down a sign and the pitcher is constantly shaking because they're not together, well, then that eliminates any rhythm for the starting pitcher. And, you know, Cole got into a real rhythm. He was really good and really comfortable. And there were balls in the dirt that Sanchez worked on really hard in the offseason to block, and he did a great job blocking the ball. He had a ground ball in the infield and beat it out in the hole, which was great to see. He hit the home run, which was really important. But to just take it a step further with regards to Sanchez and the Yankees, the same way that the Brewers and Phillies were celebrating like they'd won a wild card, there was, because they booed Stanton at the end, there was this feeling that, wow, they didn't get the ball in play when they needed to. DJ LeMahieu didn't hit the ball to the right side. Instead, he pulled it to third and got a runner thrown out at home, which you don't generally see. The number of strikeouts in big spots, the inability to hit in a big spot, again, it's one game. And certainly not something that you should look at as something that may continue for an entire season. But then you do watch other teams and you watch them make contact and you watch them put the ball in play. And it was one of those games where I'm sure there are some Yankee fans who are like, here we go again. We face good pitching and we're vulnerable. We strike out, which translated means we get to October and we face good staffs and we are prone to striking out a lot. And that happened. It was yesterday, but it was like a tap on the shoulder. The same way that Lucas Giolito was really good and it tapped on the shoulder like, Lucas is back. I remember that guy. He's really good. Or Brian Hayes is really good. It was just a subtle reminder that it's the same lineup for the most part, and they have some of the same flaws, and they have some of the same great assets when they're warm.
The day started, of course, with the news that we got about the Nationals game against the Mets being postponed. And look, by the end of this year, after the teams play 162 games, we probably will. That'll be something like, oh, yeah, that's right. Opening day was postponed. They'll make up the game. They'll move on. We at ESPN, of course, were devastated because this was our, you know, this was our primetime game with primetime players and Francisco Lindor, you know, potentially having his first plate appearance for the Mets in the first inning. So that was a real bummer. But as the day went along, you understood, OK, that's just one game. You had a chance to have a conversation with Commissioner Rob Manfred as that decision was being made. Tell me about what you learned from him.
Well, I think the important sort of part of all of it is it was literally as the decision was being made. We were interviewing him for Baseball Tonight. And that was just about the time that the press release was being typed up. It hadn't even been typed up. And in fact, the timing of it was such that as we were doing that interview, I think there was a place where I was, you know, prepared to ask if they were going to cancel more than just one game. And, you know, his response was, we're canceling, we're postponing one game. We haven't yet even let the press release out. So I think there was some inclination that they knew they were likely to postpone Saturday's game too, but it was literally in the moment and they weren't sure. And a lot of balls were in the air with regards to how big this problem was going to be with regards to postponements. So you could tell that there was a bunch of anxiety around it. And given the fact that it was the Nationals for the second year in a row, and they had gone through the entire spring without any positive tests, you know, it certainly set you off kilter. So there was a great level of discomfort in the moment. I think, as you said, as you got through the day, you recognized, look, the NFL canceled games. These things, in spite of the fact there were vaccines, et cetera, are going to happen. I'm hopeful that what comes out of it is the ability to deal with it and learn from how they dealt with it last year and learn how different organizations and different sports are dealing with it to minimize it. But very, very, very frustrating. I was on the Zoom call because I was doing the game on radio. I was on the Zoom call with Mike Rizzo the day before. And one of the reporters during our Zoom call with Rizzo said to him, so last year we saw with the Marlins and the Cardinals, you know, ultimately games were postponed and we had to make them up. And he was very defiant. He said, we will be playing. We are going to play. And, I don't know if you saw that, but that obviously turned out not to be the case. But because of the way things have been handled in the past and the way they got through spring, he probably felt very confident in the fact that this was contained and limited and we can field a team and we're going to play. And, you know, the other part of this, which is understandable, but also in a way, you know, frustrating, is we aren't told, you know, other than the three positives, how wide this may go. No one knows. No one really knows who the players are that are involved in it. And you think you could field a team if there are three positives, but clearly there's something more that indicates we A, may have more, or because of contact tracing, it could be, you know, up to X number of players. So we can't field a team, even with a team, a minor league team to go grab. And that's the part that's like, well, so really what are we dealing with? And unfortunately, and for reasons that are understandable with privacy, we don't know.
Yeah, maybe we'll find out later today. I was on that Zoom call, and it's funny because I'm sure you had similar conversations. You know, folks at ESPN were wondering, is there a chance this game's going to get postponed? And I told several people, I'm like, well, he was pretty definitive. Mike was pretty definitive in saying we are going to play. And then on Thursday morning, obviously, that all changed. But again, in the end, we got the first day in the books. There are a lot of great moments. We're going to have a lot of great moments going forward. Ravi, thanks for doing this.
Have a great game this weekend. Thanks, Buster.
On Mike Greenberg's radio show yesterday, he had on Commissioner Rod Manfred, and he talked to him about potentially moving the All-Star game out of Georgia.
The All-Star game is 3 months away. Mm-hmm. Moving a game that you plan for years in advance is not an easy thing. Having said that, I am talking to various constituencies in the game, the MLBPA, the Players Alliance, owners, and we're talking about what baseball's response should be.
He also talked to him about the future of the designated hitter in the National League and expanded playoffs.
We're going to play with no designated hitter in the National League this year, mm-hmm. And we're going to be in the pre-2020 playoff format. You know, we like that format with the wild card. We always felt that those wild card games are great for our fans. They love those knockout games. Whether those things change after 2021 is going to be a product of the conversations we have with the Players Association over the course of this season.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of the show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Buster. Just go to Indeed.com/Buster right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Buster. Terms and conditions apply.
For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Todd Radom is the chief executive of our uniform and logo quiz that we host every single week. He's a graphic artist whose work can be seen on ball fields all across America, all around the world. Or you can go to his website, toddradom.com. Todd, how are you doing this week?
Buster, it's opening week is upon us. Everything is good. Hanging in there. How are you?
I'm doing great because I have a one-week winning streak. A lot of people wondering how I was so excellent last week in the weekly quiz. I think the bar had been lowered by me last year with my performance. So I got one right. And it was like a world celebration that followed up. So I'm curious to see if I can break my tie with Taylor, move ahead of him. But before we get to that, let's talk about this week's Forgotten Franchise.
All right, Buster. This week, we are going to meet the Mets. Not those Mets, but the 19th century New York Metropolitans. So the American Association, which was a major league, they played 10 seasons from 1882 to 1891, and four current NL franchises began play there: the Dodgers, Reds, Pirates, and Cardinals, all members of this American association. Today, however, we are going to talk about the New York Metropolitans, the original New York Mets, who played their home games at the first version of the Polo Grounds, which was located on the northeast corner of Central Park in Manhattan. The Mets were formed as an independent club in 1880 and were invited to join both the National League and the American Association in 1883. So here's my quiz for you to start things off, Buster. Which league did they choose?
Well, since you sent me the notes, I can say confidence both.
Both, exactly. Owners Jim Mutrie and John Day decided to place the Mets in the American Association and audaciously decided to launch a brand new National League team. Both teams played at the Polo Grounds with separate diamonds and separate grandstands, both on the same site. Kind of crazy. The National League club still plays today, and they are the San Francisco Giants. As for the Mets, they participated in the first real World Series in 1884, where they were swept by the NL champion Providence Grays in three games. The Metropolitans were no match for Providence pitcher Old Hoss Radbourne. And this is well before he had a popular Twitter account.
Right.
But Old Hoss, according to the New York Times, and this is a direct quote, struck terror to their hearts with a game one 6-0 shutout. He followed that up with a 3-1 win the following day, and they clinched the series. It was a 2 out of 3, but they played all three games. Despite the defeat, the Metropolitans were honored with a parade, which included dozens of other local baseball teams and more than 2,500 players marching in this parade. In December 1885, Day and Mutrie sold the Metropolitans to Staten Island ferry operator Erasmus Willman, who moved the club to Staten Island's St. George Cricket Grounds. The Mets, who were sometimes referred to as the Indians at this time, languished in Staten Island, Buster, and they were offloaded to the league's Brooklyn club, now the Los Angeles Dodgers, for a grand total of $15,000 at the end of the 1887 season. So three quarters of a century after that team breathed its last, the Metropolitans nickname was revived when the National League expanded in 1962. This new club, which would be housed at another version of the Polo Grounds, was formally named Mets, with the team noting the historical significance. And there we have the story of baseball's first New York Mets. Gentlemen, this week's forgotten franchise.
That's awesome. Todd, my question is, when the Mets franchise was named in 1962, was there any conversation about being sort of on the fence about whether or not they were going to go with that name, or was that the feeling of, yep, that's got to be it?
Well, the club held a contest, and there were a bunch of interesting suggestions, including Gotham's and Meadowlarks, I believe, a whole slew of them. But Mets emerged victorious. And if I'm not mistaken, Buster, I think we had a question in our quiz last season, which revolved around the fact that it was a punchy four-letter word, and the headline writers loved it.
Exactly. Oh yeah, they absolutely. You can build off of that, as Francisco Lindor is going to certainly learn going forward. All right, let's get to this week's quiz.
All right, guys, here we go. Name the only active pitcher to have thrown a shutout and hit a home run on the same opening day. Was it Justin Verlander, Sonny Gray, Lance Lynn, or Clayton Kershaw? Threw a shutout and hit a home run on the same opening day.
Who you get, Taylor?
I'm going to go with my guy Lance Lynn on this one.
I'm going to go with Clayton Kershaw, and all I can say is I hope I'm right.
Buster, you are right. It was Clayton Kershaw in 2013 with a doing it all performance, hitting a home run and pitching a shutout on opening day. So, wow, this is really something here.
Well, I hope I would get it because I covered the game.
Oh, that's an unfair advantage.
Well, he pitched against, if I believe correct, who was it that was on the other side of that? Was it Bumgarner was on the other side of that?
I'm pretty sure it was. I don't have that in my
notes. Yeah, I think that's right. And that's what I remember. And Clayton being so happy as he rounded the bases. Taylor, what do you think? A little unfair for me?
Yeah, I mean, you've stone cold known the last two questions. So, Todd, ratchet up the heat a little bit, my man.
Well, Taylor, this is what we're going to do next week. And I'm already switching the order of a couple of things. I'm going to throw a color question in for Buster.
Oh, no.
We need competitive balance here in this league.
Yeah, you're going to be going teal and aqua and all those things. And I'm just going to have no chance. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, you'll go with something as simple as name the color scheme of this team, and I will have no clue.
I'm already on it. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, my goodness. All right, Todd. Well, I look forward to that next week. Thank you.
All right, guys. Thanks.
So we had all kinds of elements prepared for opening day for our first broadcast, Mets versus Nationals, and one of those was this interview that I did the other day with Francisco Lindor. This was fun.
What is the process for picking your hair?
So it's between me and my stylist, my hairstylist. We typically go of how bold and how clean we want it, and that's the start. And then after that, we decide, all right, what color are we going to go? Are we going to go with something bright? Are we going to do something that nobody has done? Or are we going to do something more that's going to blend in with the crowd?
So your teammates say you got a lot of different gloves, and then on a different day, you'll pick a different color. How do you make that choice, and how many gloves do you have?
Yeah, this year I'll probably have about 12, 15 gloves, and I change them depending on pants color and arm sleeves.
So. You just donated $1 million to your old high school, and there'll be a building with your name on it. What was the biggest trouble you got in when you were in high school?
One time I wore the wrong shoes. They were like, remember the Crocs? I used those to class one time. I got in the biggest trouble ever. So,
why did they call you Mr. Smile?
All I do is smile, man. That's all I do. I'm a happy person. I'm blessed. I'm humbled to be in my position. I have a great life, an outstanding family. Why not smile?
Rock Kubatko covers the Orioles for Madison Sports. And Rock, how you doing? How was your spring?
Good. I mean, different, obviously. I didn't cover spring training in person for the first time since 97, but I'm getting so used to Zoom calls now and live box scores that I was able to manage.
Yeah, we got to do what we got to do. And so today, because Taylor Schwenk is a huge Orioles fan, I'm going to defer to him and let him ask the first question as we wrap up our division by division previews with the Orioles going last, maybe appropriately. Go ahead, Taylor.
All right, Rock, two things for you. First, is there any hope for any part of this pitching staff at all? It seems like the offense might be decent, but the pitching, yikes. And and I got to get your favorite crab dish, not crabs, but, you know, maybe some crab dip, a crab pretzel, crab cake. What do you prefer?
I'll do that one first. My mom makes the best crab cake that I've ever had. And I've had a lot of crab cakes. I'm going to give her the free plug there. It is impressive. Very little filler. You know, the back fin crab, the chunks of crab meat, a little bit of Dijon mixed in there, and it's heavenly. And as for the pitching staff, the rotation, not heavenly, but there are some things I think to look forward to. I think John Means, those last four starts of the season when he gave up one and earned run in each start, that was the John Means we could, I think, expect this season where, you know, he's not looking for top velocity on the fastball, dialed it down a little bit, had better command. Wasn't pitching angry after having a tough talk with Brandon Hyde, some tough love, had him just be more composed, relaxed on the mound. He was more in control, and I think he's going to have a really impressive year. And, you know, there are going to be growing pains with the kids, but I think it's still encouraging to have a Dean Kramer, a Bruce Zimmerman in the rotation, eventually Keegan Aiken getting there, and then you're going to start seeing more of the young guns kind of filter in, the Zach Lowthers, Michael Bauman, maybe an Alexander Wells, and then the next wave behind them, whether it's D.L. Hall, Grayson Rodriguez, and I think fans will be able to envision more what this whole process has been about, the rebuild, so much of it depending on the drafting and development of these young pitchers, these young starters, to where they can have what they think is going to be a dominant homegrown rotation. Will that, you know, 21 and see a lot of wins because of it? Probably not, but I think they're really pointed in the right direction. That's something to get excited about.
And obviously a big part of 2021, the most important part for the Orioles are setting foundation pieces in place. Who do you think that those guys might be this year that by the end of the year you say, okay, this guy is going to be a part of the future when the Orioles turn the corner?
Well, Austin Hayes, certainly, if he can give them a healthy season, and that's a big if, he's got all the tools. He had a huge spring training. And they see him where he could, you know, be the everyday center fielder. They love the arm so much that he could be their right fielder. He's going to play some left. I think they're going to keep rotating him depending on if Cedric Mullins has a good year and he can stay in center field. Then you kind of move Austin around. But they've loved this kid since they drafted him out of Jacksonville. But there's just been a succession of injuries, and the last couple have been flukish. So you can't say, well, the kid's soft. I mean, he gets drilled in the ribs by a fastball last summer. One spring in minor league camp, he dove into second base and fractured his thumb. It's been things like that that have held him back. You get a full season out of him, I think he really blows up. And Ryan Mountcastle, who came up in late August, he is a legit middle-of-the-order bat. And, you know, he's playing his fourth position since they drafted him in left field. He was a shortstop, third baseman, first baseman, now in left. And he's certainly adequate in left, and are going to keep working with him. They think he'll be fine. But he also can play some first base. The DH spot's not clogged. They're going to rotate players in that. So, you know, he'll get some at-bats there. And, you know, there's just a lot to like about him. And he's not just a guy swinging from the heel, hitting long home runs. But the kid can hit, wait on a breaking ball, take it to right field. He has a really good approach. He's become more patient where he's not striking out as much. He's drawing a lot more walks than he did in the minors. So I think those are two right there that can be big pieces of this rebuild.
This is a completely unfair question because, of course, you haven't been able to be in the clubhouse. You haven't been able to be around the players as much. But just in talking with folks, I want to ask you this. You know, under Buck Showalter, the Orioles were known as a team which had a really strong clubhouse culture. And it was something that I think they took a lot of pride in. What's the clubhouse culture like now as this team goes through this transition?
I think it's still that same thing. And you hear that from players. When they arrived, they talk about how they were like, you know, Jose Iglesias or even Nelson Cruz back in the day. They always say they show up and they're immediately welcomed and they're one of the guys. And, you know, an Adley Rutschman that you think, you know, is number two prospect in all baseball might have gotten, you know, the treatment when he was in the clubhouse the last spring and this spring from some veterans. And instead, it's like that warm welcome and there's no hazing and everybody's there trying to help. And it's not like there are a lot of veterans that provide leadership. They've been smart enough to bring in a few guys here and there, especially when Trey Mancini wasn't around last spring and summer to kind of help with that. But it's a really, really good culture. And I've said this before, Brandon Hyde deserves a lot of credit because he's performing a really interesting and delicate balancing act where he understands it's a rebuild. He knows the sacrifices you make. He knows you can't judge this team right now on wins and losses. And yet he's got to go in that clubhouse and tell these guys, hey, we're trying to win every night. We're not going to be satisfied with just trying to be competitive. We play every night to win games. We don't even talk about the rebuild in here, but he's still on board with it. So that's a really tricky balance. And guys buy into it. They all say, hey, we understand what's going on here, but we're here to win. And we're not going to roll over and say, well, it doesn't matter. It matters to them. And so Brandon deserves a lot of credit. I don't know if a lot of managers would be able to pull that off. And he's done that.
So the best story of the organization, no doubt about it, Trey Mancini coming back from cancer to play this year. What have you heard about him?
It's amazing. And he had told us this before. And then the proof came when he reported. He goes, you know, people look at me and you would never know what I had been through. And you figure, how is that possible? A stage 3 diagnosis, colon cancer, the surgery, a whole summer spent with chemotherapy treatments that went through September 21st. We weren't sure how that was going to affect him physically, his energy level once he got to camp, once, you know, there was the heavier workload. And yet there were no restrictions from him from day one. He was just one of the guys in the same schedule. He started playing back-to-back games. They kept him out of right field, but he was first base DH and had a really good spring. Had a couple home runs. The power's still going to come. But hit like .333, good on base percentage, and just looked like he did back in 2019. So it's a tremendous story. And again, nobody, the doctors didn't know, the club didn't know. There was no way to really know for sure until he got there how he was going to perform with a year off like that and what his body endured. And it's really amazing that he seems to be all the way back and obviously is going to get a huge ovation on opening day and certainly the home opener on April 8th. It's really, really impressive. And they really missed him. They missed just his presence in that clubhouse, not just in the lineup. They missed having him around last summer for a variety of reasons. And he's arguably kind of the face of this franchise now. It used to be Buck back in the day, even though he didn't want that title, but it really was or it was Adam Jones or some other guys, and Nick Markakis. They're long gone. So it's really Trey Mancini now.
All right, Rock. Maybe you'll be the face of the franchise by the end of the year. Thanks for doing this.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Bleacher Tweets. Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for a Friday. First up, I want to mention White Sox at Angels Sunday night on ESPN Radio. Tune in at 7:30 for pregame coverage and watch it on ESPN at 8:37 p.m. Eastern time. And also courtside, Greenberg and Dockage Final Four this weekend. We previewed it this week. We're going to be up early to preview the national championship on Sunday morning. So do check that out wherever you get your podcasts. Onto the tweets. First up, a lot of this coming in on hashtag Bleacher Tweets. Joe Wilkins at August West 27 writes in, congrats, Buster, on the most successful April Fool's tweet that I've ever seen. Well done, sir. You got a lot of that in your response to announcing that the game between the Nationals and the Mets was postponed.
Oh, my goodness. I got so many responses along those lines. And, of course, there were Mets and Nationals fans, baseball fans also tweeting out, please say this is an April Fool's joke. Please say it's April Fool's, but unfortunately, no.
Not messing around on that one. Next up, let's go to PK Steinberg. He writes in, is there a better bromance buster in baseball than Bryce Harper in the Philly Fanatic?
That's a pretty good one. And you know what? That's Bryce knowing his audience. I'm really curious about Francisco Lindor, you know, what he does to ingratiate himself to Mets fans, you know, with his color of hair, his color of gloves, something to do with Mr. Met. Don't be surprised if you see a relationship develop there.
Next up, we've got Christopher Savage and Coach DeMattis both asking for a favorite or memorable opening day memory. Anything come to mind today?
Yeah, you know, one of my favorite ones was the first game played at Coors Field in 1995. It was a crazy game between the Rockies and the Mets. Back and forth. The Mets had a lead 9-8. I think it was Mike Remlinger, the pride of Dartmouth, who was on the mound for the Mets. I want to say it was in the bottom of the 14th inning, couple runners on base, and Dante Bichette hit a no-doubter to left field. And it was the sort of thing you see of a lot now, but you didn't see a lot then, is he immediately looked toward the Rockies dugout and began to shake his fist like, it's over. Won this one. That was a pretty cool moment.
And last one for today from our friend Cameron Black at blind_QB. This is an interesting one. He writes in, sometime this season, I will be throwing out the first pitch at a Royals game. As you might be able to tell from my Twitter handle, I am totally blind, but I don't want to be one of those first pitches that is remembered for how terrible it is, even if I am blind. Any advice? And he followed up by saying he wants to announce his presence with authority to quoth Bull Durham.
I'd say this, warm up. You know, I've done it, I want to say 4 or 5 times, and I had some jitters, and it would definitely help to warm up. You know, there's the famous story of President Bush before that memorable first pitch during the 2001 World Series going down to the bullpen. He was warming up because he had on a bulletproof vest, and he had to work out around that. And Derek Jeter came down and said to him, just don't bounce it. They'll boo you. So Dr. Fauci last year, before the first game of that season, I was watching him. I'm like, oh boy, I hope he's warming up a little bit. He didn't, and the rest is history.
My guy, John Wall, too. Also a notable poor first pitch. Cameron, you're going to do way better than that. Thanks for writing in, everyone. We appreciate it. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter as you're watching the games this weekend.
That's it for today. My thanks to Ravi, to Rock, to the chief executive, to Taylor. Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a great weekend. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something that we need to fight against every single day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, check out the Fantasy Focus podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. The Baseball Tonight podcast.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.